JC Corcoran Podcast.
Here's a little song I wrote about someone who hurt me real bad. My nose been broke, my eyes have been poked, my ears have been twisted all around. My head has been punched, my face has been scrunched, I spent a lot of time on the ground. My mouth has been smacked, my teeth have been cracked, I've had to spit out a lot of grass. But nothing I say compares to the day when you kicked my heart's ass. My lip has been split to where I'm dribbling spit, and I thought for sure that I would die. I've coughed up blood while my face was in mud, with my spurs aiming up at the sky. Bottles have been broken off my head while I've been choking on a meal of broken glass. But nothing I say compares to the day when you kicked my heart's ass. No, nothing I say compares to the day when you kicked my heart's ass. Darling, I never walked away from a fight in my life. I always lay there, bleeding, gasping, and hoping that I would live to see you again. I've had guys the size of mountains hurt me so bad, I'm amazed I'm still alive. So tell me, how is it possible that a little sweet thing like you is capable of giving a heart such an ass whooping? My butt's been kicked as my head's been sticked in commodes from coast to coast. I've been kicked, punched, smacked, choked, face crunched, eyes poked, burned into cigarette toast. I've been beat so bad that the doctors had to put me in a full body cast. But nothing I say compares to the day when you kicked my heart's ass. No, nothing I say compares to the day when you kicked my heart's ass. How horrible it feels to be head over heels when you kicked my heart's ass. You kicked my heart's ass.
Now I'm just getting warmed up.
Happy to see you again.
Don't be nervous, don't be rocky. You're a teenage guest is jockey now.
And let me begin by wishing you a beautiful look.
Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over again.
Second of August, 2021, JC here at jconline.com. We publish every weekday morning at about 7 o'clock, but you already know that. And for the next couple of days, we're going to be coming to you from Louisville, Kentucky, and I'll explain that tomorrow as soon as we get there. All right, a little Olympic stuff to kick things off. These beach volleyball costumes the women have to wear, is in my imagination, are they getting smaller and smaller? If you've been paying attention to this, you know that some of the women's teams are pushing back on this and saying, hey, just wait a minute here. The guys, when they play volleyball, they get to wear regular swimsuits, and when we play beach volleyball, we're wearing a couple of postage stamps. Now, I'm going to tell you, I always thought that the women, the beach volleyball girls, that they wanted costumes that small. I figured it had something to do with being on the beach and being unencumbered while you're trying to play beach volleyball and everything. I just assumed that it was their idea to have the swimsuits that small, but it turns out that's not the case at all. Like you said, they're getting a lot of pushback. And then you get those hugs after every point. And if you're into those scenes in the pornographic movies where it's girl, girl, I don't know, maybe there's a little something else going on there too. It turns out that the hugs actually have a strategic purpose, because the timekeeper, and I didn't even know in beach volleyball you had a timekeeper, but this is why every 4 years we wake up and go, huh? But they don't hit the clock until the girls separate after having celebrated after the point. So it gives them a little bit of a breather. Well, the guys at home are having a heavy breather, but it gives them a little chance to recuperate after the point, and that's how that works. It just seems like these bodies are all the same. And when they're playing, you don't really see anything but the body because they usually have visors or something on, and then they have these huge goggles that cover most of their face. It's like they're wearing a windshield. And so really all you're seeing is these perfectly toned 6-foot-tall bodies with not a molecule of body fat on them. And then after you win, you get interviewed and they take all that stuff off and you're like, hey, I was just masturbating to you the whole time while you were playing the game. And now I'm looking at your face and there's not much there. And there was a woman yesterday, I think her name was April something, and they were interviewing her. And as she was talking, did you see the size of her hands? I mean, they're all tall, they're all thin, none of them have any boobs, and I mean none. And I'm telling you, this chick, she had hands the size of toilet seats. It was unbelievable. Our buddy Ken Flack, who passed away in recent years, but he was from Kirkwood and won the Olympic gold medal for tennis doubles, along with his buddy Bob Siguso. And Ken Flack, you might recall, used to do the show with us all the time, and he had a lovely bride named Sandy and the whole thing. He didn't even know where his gold medals were. He didn't even know where they were. I'd be using that fucking thing as a door knocker. And it was interesting because we were talking to Meatloaf a couple of years back. And he's like, yeah, I heard these people say they don't know where their Grammy is. Oh, yeah, I don't know where it is. It's like, hey, I know where mine is. It's sitting right on my piano. I look at it every single day. I stare at it. I love it. Don't give me any of that stuff about you don't know where your award is. If you want an Oscar, you want a Grammy, you want a gold medal at the Olympics, hang it from the chandelier. Let's talk a little MTV. If you were watching television over the weekend, they did a lot of 40th anniversary stuff because it was the 40th anniversary yesterday. Even satellite radio was tied up with all of them together. And it was interesting because all of the originals got together and they were doing shows and stuff like that. It was sort of funny because they had Nina Blackwood on, who I just assumed was probably 80 by now, and Nina Blackwood, it turns out, is 68. Before she was discovered by MTV, she used to play the harp in a classy restaurant in downtown, classy hotel in downtown Cleveland for some reason, and also she posed nude in Playboy. She wasn't the centerfold or anything, but there she was, and it was I think back in the day we called them beeve shots. So she had sort of a interesting background before she came to MTV. Martha Quinn, she was the baby of the group, and her mother was the CBS financial news reporter for years and years and years with Walter Cronkite and everything, and Dan Rather. Her name was Jane Bryant Quinn, so she was very, very well connected. And, of course, our buddy Smash made it on there for a summer. He was a summer replacement guy. And still is on the list. I think he's number 44 on the greatest moments of all time on MTV. And you can look that up yourself. It's a great story, though, involving Guns N' Roses. They sent me up there because we were owned by the same company, Viacom, at the time. And I say we, it was Channel 4. So they said, go up there and we're going to have you just hang out on MTV for a couple of days. And everybody was really nice to me. You walk in and it almost gave you the feeling of a high school yearbook office the day before deadline. It was nuts in there. And Kurt Loder, let me get the year. The year I was up there was 1993. And at the time, he was 47. So if my calculations are right, that dude is 75 years old right now. And that's just crazy to think that the guy who used to do the MTV news right now is 2 years younger than Joe Biden. And the guy who, along with one other name that doesn't get mentioned very often by the name of Doug Herzog, but the guy who basically launched MTV is a guy by the name of Bob Pittman. And he is the guy that has had the controls of a broadcast group called iHeartRadio. A lot of people refer to it as I Hate Radio because he took the entire, I think they have something like 750 stations spread across the country, including, I think it's 6 of them that are in St. Louis. And he reduced the entire company to an app. And people are like, listening to an app is not the same as listening to radio. Thus, the comment that said, "I heart radio. I hate radio." That company, by the way, and you're gonna hear this and you're gonna say, no, you can't possibly know what you're talking about here. But trust me, this has been one of the biggest stories in the broadcast industry, sort of behind the scenes, the stuff that you guys never heard anything about. But that company is $22 billion in the red. That's $22 billion with a B. So yeah, they got 750 radio stations, but what's this? Is a little something here on your credit card. And there were reporters on television, stuff like that, because there was a lot of stuff about the anniversary, the 40th anniversary of MTV on over the weekend. And a lot of people going, the first song ever played on MTV was by the Buggles. And it's like, hey, my daughter's 11 years old and she knows that. You want to impress me? Tell me the second song ever played on MTV, which was Thank You Very Much, You Better Run by Pat Benatar.
The A-List Interview with JC and the Morning Show Graham.
MTV VJ Kennedy.
There you were rubbing elbows with all the big music stars and celebrities of the day. But there were also, you know, those millions of kids out there, many of them in small towns, a lot of them having trouble fitting in.
You know, the point was for kids who especially, you know, didn't have somewhere to go, that if they were going to watch MTV, to feel like they were a part of something. Like, we never wanted it to be something where we thought we were better than the viewers, because we were screwing around as much as anyone. And we wanted you to feel like this was the greatest party thrown by the most popular person you knew, and you were invited. That's what it was supposed to be like.
She tried to pick me up at the Grammys one year. Honest to God, I was very attracted to her, too. You're very smart, very attractive. There's something about those Lisa Loeb glasses. And I love those Lisa Loeb commercials, by the way. I don't even know what they're for. I just know that I like that song and I like her, and she still looks great. There was a period after my divorce back in the 1990s where I figured, well, where are the girls? And a lot of the girls were listening to a radio station called The River, because they played all that, you know, Paula Cole, Sheryl Crow, Sarah McLachlan, The Corrs. And sure enough, so I started, you know, following that radio station, and all of those acts were coming into St. Louis all the time, playing Mississippi Nights and places like that. So I started going to those places because I figured that's where the girls are, and I was right. The only problem was they were all 26, anorexic, you know, kind of have a Diet Coke and a cigarette for lunch every day. Then you had that Lilith Fair, and let me just tell you something. This isn't part of my stand-up comedy routine. You know, the whole idea that a woman says, yes, it's a sisterhood. It's a sisterhood. Let's go hear four non-blondes sing. Then they get to the show and they got to pay their own parking. They had already had to buy their own ticket because no guy is going to go with them. Their boyfriends are all at home. Now the show starts. It's like, honey, go get me a beer. Oh, that's right. There's no honey with me here. If I want a beer, I got to go pay for it myself. And that was the end of the Lilith Fair. As soon as the women found out, they had to pay for everything themselves. And that was the end of that. And just to show you how weird things are, maybe it's just the dating scene that is weird or was weird back then, but I was going to all these shows, you know, Alanis Morissette. You know, what was the Kiss Me song? The Sixpence None the Richer. Yeah. So I was going to all of those shows. And I mean, the girls were there, but like I said, they were these sort of forlorn looking skinny bleach blondes. And like I said, just to show you how weird things are, I got virtually no action out of any of that. But then one night, I got invited to the Coruscant Ballroom at the Chase Park Plaza for the unveiling of the Rams Super Bowl video, and I met a girl there that I ended up with for like the next 3.5 years from the sports thing. Like I said, it's either life or maybe it's just dating. That was weird back then. This is the anniversary of an event that it took place back in 1984. And I ask you to try to recall the scene in Goodfellas where Joe Pesci thinks he's going to be officially declared a made man. He's all dressed up and they take him in the car and he gets out of the car and he's strutting and he's so excited. It's the biggest day of his life. They open the doors. He walks into the restaurant. It's completely empty. And he goes, ah, geez. And he realizes they're not going to make him a made man. They're going to whack him. And right there, they shoot him in the head. Just try to think of that scene here for a moment, and let me set the scene for you. It's 1984. I'd only been on the air a couple of months. This is over at Keishi. When you apply for a job, it's the old TNR, tape and resume. Everybody knows what resume is. The tape is you take a radio show that you've done, and you edit it down. You take all the music out, all the commercials out, and you just put the parts where you're talking, and you edit that down to 2 or 3 minutes, and you send that tape out along with your resume, and the guy running the radio station listens to it and says, hey, this guy sounds pretty good. Send me some more stuff. And then you send more. Send me some more of your work. And then you do that. And then by then, you usually have the job. And that's how all of that works. So when I applied for the job in the spring of 1984, I was sitting in Buffalo, New York, trying to get the hell out of there. And I sent it to St. Louis. They called me up. The negotiations began. And the next thing you know, I'm on the air. Memorial Day weekend of 1984. So now, obviously, it's only 2 months. I've been on the air about 9 weeks. And the management of Keishi says, hey, we'd like to have lunch with you and maybe have a little meeting and everything like that at the Viking Lodge right there on the edge of Crestwood. So we'll see you at noon tomorrow. Okay, great. Boom. I come walking in, and there was an eerie feeling. That's all I can tell you, just an eerie feeling. I open up the doors, I walk into the conference room, and there's nobody there. And sitting in the middle of the table, the big conference table, sitting right there in the middle, strategically placed, is a cassette tape player. And I'm looking around like, what's going on here? They said, we would like you to, they're very nice. And they said, we would like you to listen to something. I'm like, okay. And they push the play button. And what is it? It's the tape that I had sent them to get the job. I was like, okay, I understand what this is. What's the point of having played this for me? They said, this is what we hired. What you're doing on the air right now is not what's on this tape. I said, well, the tape was just a sample of what I was doing in Buffalo. What I was doing in Buffalo, I picked it up right away. It would never work here. So you make adaptations. You say, okay, I'll take this part of my act and downplay this, but I'll play this up because this will play better here at this particular station in this particular strategic competitive situation. And it's just a smart thing to do. What I did in Buffalo, I don't think would work here. It's still the same act. It's all really the same stuff. It's just a little bit different in terms of the delivery. Well, they weren't buying it. And they were basically telling me, we want you to do more of this stuff that's on the tape and less of what you're doing on the air, what you've been doing for the last 2 months. I drove home and I got on the phone and I started checking availabilities around the country. I remember there was an opening at a station in Houston and I almost went there because I thought I was getting whacked. It all almost stopped on that date. August 2nd, 1984. I almost didn't get any further than that. 2 friggin' months. But how does the story end? The story ends by a month later, the first ratings came out since I had gone on the air. So this was going to be the first indication of how we were doing. And in late September, it showed like a 40% jump in the morning ratings, and then they shut up and they never said anything again. And we went on to have the highest ratings for any FM radio station in the history of St. Louis at the time. We were breathing right down the necks of KMOX. It was unbelievable. And that's a record that'll never be broken, by the way. It'll never be broken. But it all almost came to a screeching halt on this date in 1984. And now this.
We have full coverage tonight, beginning with Von Hilliard in Florida.
The United States topping 100,000 new coronavirus cases just Friday. A stunning fourth wave, with the number of infections and seriousness of the moment rising each day.
Things are going to get worse. If you look at the acceleration of the number of cases, the 7-day average has gone up substantially.
The virus surging in states from the west to the east. Cases doubling in more than 40 of them over the last 2 weeks.
This is a class 5 hurricane.
More Florida residents tested positive for COVID this weekend than at any other point during the pandemic. Hospitals in Jacksonville and Orlando are already breaking previous hospitalization records. In neighboring Alabama, more than 1,200 people are currently hospitalized, and COVID unit doctors say August will be even worse.
The number of cases by Labor Day will be more than twice the number of cases we saw at the worst time in January. That's what we're about to face, and the public isn't ready for that.
And in Texas, overwhelmed hospitals struggling to hire additional nurses and staff.
They're not finding the uptake, even dramatically increasing the pay they pay.
40% of the country is still not fully vaccinated, and those individuals are making up more than 90% of COVID hospitalizations, forcing hospitals today to build out new COVID units, this one in Baton Rouge.
In the last 24 hours, we opened up our fourth COVID ICU because of the surge of patients requiring critical care. Younger and sicker quicker. They're just getting sick very quickly.
Among the 100 million unvaccinated, some encouraging news, vaccination rates doubling this week in several hotspots.
This may be a tipping point for those who have been hesitant to say, okay, it's time.
All this while Chicago's major music festival Lollapalooza continues on tonight as Americans try to hold on to what the country hoped would be its Renaissance summer.
Well, there it is, folks. That was the NBC Evening News last night, Sunday night. These are dire warnings. I mean, some of these doctors and health administrators and stuff like that, you can see the look of absolute terror on their faces. They are scared to death, and you've heard the predictions right there. In the meantime, this whole insanity about politicizing the idea of wearing masks. Tennessee Republican lawmaker David Byrd had accused the Democrats of sensationalizing the whole pandemic. He is now begging his fellow Republicans to take COVID seriously after spending 55 days on a ventilator and having a liver transplant due to the virus. Tennessee Republican David Byrd ended up with a new liver out of the deal. I don't think he necessarily wanted one. The two states with the governors who are Trump clones, that would be Greg Abbott of Texas and Ron DeSantis of the state of Florida, where they have been fighting the whole idea of COVID tooth and nail, fighting the idea of the vaccine, fighting the idea of the masks, passing all sorts of ridiculous laws to keep scientists and doctors from doing their jobs. Those two states alone now account for 40% of all of the COVID cases in this country. The state of Florida on Saturday reported 21,000 cases in one day. And I'm going to tell you something about this, and this is sort of, I guess the word is morbid, but when this whole thing started happening, it was like clear that the older you were, the more your health was at risk with regard to this whole thing. And it was sort of like we were being told by certain corners of the political community, look, the overwhelming percentage of the population is healthy and probably not susceptible to all of this, and it's pretty much grandma and grandpa and people in nursing homes, and those are the ones who are really going to get hit by this. And that certainly turned out to be the case, or at least half of it did, because certainly grandma and grandpa started, people are just starting dropping like flies if you're over the age of 65. But those same people who were saying that were ignoring the fact that a lot of people under the age of 65 were getting sick and dying from the whole thing. They didn't want to talk about that. But again, it's been the senior citizen population of this country that appears to be at greatest risk in this whole thing. That's what it appeared to be, you know, during the first wave and during the second wave. Well, now, as you heard in the NBC report, you got hospitals reporting 150% increases just since last week. 150%! And they made reference to the one children's hospital in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where it's almost all kids. Wait till the kids start dying from this. Wait till the kids start dying. We'll see how far DeSantis and Abbott get with their nonsense. DeSantis thinks he's going to be the next president. He might not end up being able to get a job as dog catcher by the time this whole thing plays out. I want to say a big, fat, hearty congratulations to Ted Simmons, who had a really, really nice weekend in St. Louis. New statue. Speaking of baseball, if there is a Chicago Cub fan anywhere in your family or in your close circle of friends, you might want to send flowers. I'm not exaggerating this. I've been on the phone with my sister doing crisis intervention. She lives in the Chicago suburbs, and I know St. Louis Cardinal fans have a little bit of empathy somewhere down deep that comes out once in a while when you watch the Chicago National League franchise stumble and fall. And this is almost like the team plane went down. This is how it feels for Chicago Cub fans. Can you imagine if the Cardinals traded Nolan Arenado, Paul Goldschmidt, throwing DeYoung, and a couple of pitchers, and they haven't even won a World Series like the guys who were the nucleus of the Chicago Cubs the last couple of years? By the way, Javi Baez, Chris Bryant, who got sent to San Francisco, and Anthony Rizzo, who got sent to the New York Yankees, all three of them hit home runs in their first game with their new teams. And Tony La Russa's got a first-place team up in Chicago, and he's still brawling at 77. There's some beanball action going on in the game over the weekend, and here comes Tony out of the dugout at 77, going after a catcher for the other team who's 50 years younger and could flip him like Don Zimmer got flipped when he was coaching for the Yankees. I shouldn't laugh, but it's so absurd. You know, Tony La Russa's the same age as Joe Biden, okay? Can you imagine Joe Biden going after a 25-year-old and having any sort of chance against him? Tony continues to entertain, huh? Like pretty much everybody I know, I fight the scale on a regular basis. And with the pandemic, and a lot of people had to fight this battle too, with the pandemic, I put on a little weight. And so I just said, this is ridiculous. I look like hell. I got to get this stomach down. And I got to approach this from the standpoint of, got to get under 200 pounds. Just get under 200 pounds and then start chipping away, continuing to chip away. So I was eating corn and tomatoes and fruit and vegetables and trying to control my portions. And so yesterday, I get on the scale at 199.8. 199.8 for the first time in a while. I take out the phone. I take a picture of the digital readout on the scale, 199.8, and I send it to my wife. I text it to her, and she responds, "That's the price of gas? It's back to almost $2 a gallon?" I'm like, no, that's how much I weigh. I was hoping for a more enthusiastic response. Want to hear something scary? David Letterman's son this November turns 18. Harry Letterman will turn 18 in November. You want another one? Eddie Munster. Butch Patrick is 68. Some other birthdays today: Kevin Smith, Silent Bob, 51. Mary Louise Parker, hell of an actress from Weeds and The West Wing, and gosh, she's good, 57 today. Apollonia Cotero from Purple Rain, 62. And The Sixth Sense with Bruce Willis and Haley Joel Osment premiered in Philadelphia on this date, 1999, 22 years ago today. It only made $26 million in its opening weekend, but went on to a box office total of $294 million as word spread. Oh my God, you got to see this movie. And finally, a new study finds that Americans think showers are more relaxing than baths. R. Kelly responded, "Define shower." And with that, we say bye-bye. That's it. August 2nd edition of the J.C. Corcoran Podcast here at jconline.com is in the can. We're available not only here, but on platforms all over the place. Just look around. Tell your friends that we're here doing this podcast every weekday morning. We publish at 7 a.m. You have a great day. We'll talk to you from Louisville, Kentucky tomorrow morning. I'll explain all of that later on. In the meantime, we've beaten this one to death. Have a good one. See you later. Bye.
J.C. Corcoran Podcast.